It's Wednesday, April 6, 2011, and you're listening to episode 227 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 1 hour and 1 minute. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name's Chad.
This is Wayne.
My name is Pat.
And this is Chris.
First off on this show, I want to start by thanking a gentleman by the name of Chris Ings, Foxfang on the forum. About a year ago, he started work for us on a bunch of custom painted mechs, which got sent to Chris. And then Chris apparently had a conversation with me, which I only vaguely remember, where Chris said, should I ship these down to you? And I said, no, just give them to me in person at Fear the Cons. I don't want to risk damage in shipping because they're, you know, fairly delicate things. They have like antennas and stuff on them. Okay, so that part, you know, totally on me. Until Chris brings them down, I don't see a bit of them until after Chris uses them in his Battletech game, then gives them to me. He's like, oh yeah, here's the stuff Chris Ng sent down to us.
Good man.
Yeah.
Good man.
Absolutely. You know, and you should be proud of the fact, A, your mech survived, and it was the command mech for the pirate forces in my Battletech event.
It was used to kill clanners, and that alone will make it worthwhile in my heart forever.
And it did very well in that role.
If we taught no one anything else at Fear the Con 4, I don't even know what the context of this is, but Limewielding Ninja posts on the forums in the What Did You Learn at Fear the Con 4 thread, Battletech is awesome, clans suck. And I just replied and said, my work is done. Fear the Boot is over.
Actually, you know, I got to give Pirate Force credit because we came up with the little phrase, you know, the shout and everything like that beforehand. And unbeknownst to me, Johnny G, who was leading the Pirate, or he wasn't leading the Pirate Force, but he was team captain, essentially. And he must have orchestrated a different shouting response to come back because everyone else was supposed to say boom and they shout clans suck. And they continued to do that for the whole thing. And it was great.
You know, I was sitting here and I'm typing the Twitter comment for this episode, and I'm vaguely hearing Dan and Chris talk, and then Dan says blah blah blah, and he's like, that's it, this episode's over, my work here is done, no more show. And then all of a sudden, I, on the side of my eye, I hear click click click, and I see Dan closing windows on the computer, and I'm like, what did I just miss?
I mean, if we're real, we're this done. Time.
Bye. See?
I
see
ya? It. You pay attention, Chad.
You won't see.
Alrighty, second thing is I want to give some love to the other podcasts that are present at Fear the Con 4. In episode 226, we gave some specific shout-outs to those that were present during the recording. But while we were recording, some of the other shows were upstairs recording their own content, but a bunch of them did a lot of work in helping promote Fear the Con 4. They did recordings on site. Several of them are releasing actual plays from the convention, including some actual plays that have the hosts in them. So if you want to Fear the Boot actual plays, as close as you're going to get, there's one with Chad in it. The next episode of the Kicked in the Dice Bags Blaxploitation game is out, which I will be in.
Oh my God, I'm
going to
be
Washington
on,
is back.
I'm going to be on Kicked in the Dice Bags again. That's like the
it's gonna
sixth
be kicked
time.
In the Chad Bags.
All right, so real quick, on the show here, I'm going to give a list of the podcasts I'm aware of that were present at Fear the Con. Please check the show notes because the specific links to various shows or feeds, you're going to need to find that in the show notes because as of the recording of this episode, I'm still waiting to get it all in, so I'm just going to wait until I have it. Go ahead, Pat.
Sorry.
I'm still waiting to have it all before I type it into the show notes. But here are the RPG podcasts that were present at Fear the Con. Dice Food and Lodging, obviously Fear the Boot. Gaming Asylum. Ideology of Madness / Funny Books, which is actually a comic book one, but nonetheless geek-related stuff, which incidentally Wayne also hosts on that show. That
I'm a dirty little whore.
Kicked in the Dice Bags.
You're not little.
Both editions. Both
but you are a whore.
Kicked in the Dice Bags, both Player and Game Master editions. Postcards from the Dungeon. Role-Playing Public Radio. The Big Hairy Podcast. And no, Chad is not on that one.
Not yet.
And Thistledown Actual Play. So those are the shows that were there, and I will put links to their relevant coverage in the notes. All right, last up, Chris, you had something stupid and old and irrelevant you wanted to say.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, the one thing that I was really surprised by at Fear the Con 4
was the effectiveness of Metamucil.
I just started listening to him.
Actually,
so
you know what? You didn't need Metamucilicon with the beans and the chili and all that fruit. Let me tell you, you did not need any fiber assistance at that con whatsoever. That aside,
Sam, could you turn this podcast around? We don't need fiber conversations.
That aside, honestly, I have to say about 83% of the people that I talked to were either...
That's an awfully specific number. 83%.
Well, you know, give or take 17 to 21%. They were either first-time Fear the Con goers or first-time con goers at all. This was their first con ever that they had ever been to was Fear the Con. And, of course, you know, I promptly told them that it's all downhill from this point.
Ah, virgins.
The sheer fact that so many people that I spoke to were first-time con goers says a lot, A, about us, says a lot about the listeners who got these people to go. And I just want to send a thank you to those people who came here for the first time ever. And without you guys essentially being that brave to come to this con and check it out and enjoy it and go back and tell your gaming group and to bring them back next year, you know, we're not going to go anywhere. Much love to the first-time con goers. Really appreciate it. Please come back next year and you'll still be liked even though it won't be, you know, your first time anymore. But it was so nice to see so many first-timers there.
We not only had first-time con goers, I know of at least a couple first-time gamers that were there.
Yeah,
people that had never gamed before, they were brought by other people.
Yep, they were there. And then, in fact, one of the interesting ones I talked to, there was a guy who's a multiple Gen Con veteran, but he said this was his first con that he's ever come to where he got to play. He's done, he either ran a bunch of stuff or, you know, was just there as kind of a consumer, but this was the first con where he got to come and just play the entire con, and he was having a blast.
So, this isn't our banter topic for today, but in the recording of 226... I said that I was going to actually clean up the recording studio and start hanging decorations, and I haven't yet nailed up the map. But as everyone here can attest, I actually did clean up the recording studio.
The map is present.
Yeah, the map is present, and the floor is visible. Which
we walked in, we looked around, and was like, "What happened in here?"
I'm still in.
There's a floor.
All right, but part of that cleanup was the rediscovery of old things lost, which includes the sexual Care Bears, and I'm pleased to see for the first time in about 3 or 3.5 years, Chad is organizing the sexual Care Bears into increasingly obscene poses on the table.
He's got are so vanilla. I mean,
they're not opposable.
We've had to settle for Pat being our sexual Care Bears since they've been lost.
Work. There you go. There's the rest of them. Get to work.
Oh, these have poseable arms. I'm going to town now, baby.
But man, this takes me back to classic Fear the Boot. All right. So what we are going to talk about with the banter topic today was, Chad, there is something you released on the blog that probably got lost in the shuffle of convention coverage. And I want you to talk about this because this is going to lead into our main topic for today, which is leading questionnaires during character creation. So let's start off by, what is it that you put on the blog that I believe got lost in the shuffle?
I wrote a role-playing game. It is a role-playing game that's very heavily based on Inception. You could almost call it an Inception role-playing game, but I had to change one or two things just to kind of make it work.
You could almost call it that, but you don't, because you don't want to be sued.
Well, I mean, it's a fan effort, of course, but yeah.
We're not selling it.
Yeah, we're not definitely not
or
selling
it. Or claiming ownership over it or whatever.
But you sure do work it.
I call it Lucid because, well, that's another thing is that throughout the play of it, if you've ever seen the movie, they're trying to go into somebody's dream and change somebody's mind or plant an idea. They're trying to incept an idea. And the movie made it clear that that's something that's very special. It's something that doesn't happen often, that doesn't happen ever, actually, except in the movie. So when you run the game, the understanding is to just try to do it as you're trying to steal things from the dream. You're trying to steal ideas and whatnot. But yeah, I wrote a role-playing game. It's about almost 5,000 words. It has all the rules to it. It is based on Dread, but I've changed Dread. Dread is by Tilting Windmills. And I changed it. There are character classes. And in Dread, you have the Jenga Tower, right? So when you do pulls from the Jenga Tower in 10 situations, if the Jenga Tower eventually collapses, somebody dies or they get turned into a zombie.
And what I love is how well this works within the Inception idiom. I'm sorry to use that word again. But I promise I'll do this in a way it's spoiler-free for anyone who hasn't seen the movie. But part of the gist of Inception is that when you're in someone else's dream, because of the fact that they are having a lucid dream, which is where Chad got the name Lucid from, what you are doing, because you're an invader into their subconscious mind, destabilizes the dream until eventually they may reach a point where they realize, I'm dreaming, this isn't real,
right?
And wake up, and you lose complete control over them.
Yeah.
And so
the dream collapses. The Jenga tower does
represents
not,
the stability
of the dream.
And it's yeah. I mean, I realize this came from Dread, but it fits this concept wonderfully.
Yeah, and it can be run without a game master, actually, but the game master looks at the tower, looks at the stability of the tower, like how many holes are in it, how it's falling apart and such. The subconscious projections within the dream, basically these sort of antibodies within the dream, the agents, as you do your thing, they become more and more aggressive, and they're trying to hunt you down, and the game master looks at the dream and the Jenga tower, and that's how stable it is. That's how stable the dream is. So if the Jenga tower has lots of holes in it, it's falling apart, the subconscious projections become more and more and more aggressive, and they start actively hunting the players down. But I also changed it from Dread, too, because, like I said, I added a character class, and the character classes were based on the characters within the dream. Each of the characters had a sort of job and title and such.
So like the architect who designs the dream.
Yes.
The chemist who creates the drug that induces the dream state.
The point man who's like the leader. And then you have the counterfeiter who can take on the appearance of anyone he wants within the dream. And each of these characters have different powers and ability that go beyond just sort of the fluff of, well, I'm a counterfeiter, I can make myself look like anything I want, to actually affecting the tower. Like the point man, he can do a pull for somebody else. Like say if you have something that's really dangerous, the game master will say, okay, we'll pull three blocks out. This is really dangerous and difficult to do. And the point man can say, okay, well, I'm going to help him do this because I have this sort of overview of the situation, and I'm helping him like this. The example we used at Fear the Con was, you're jumping a car over a drawbridge that's raising while shooting guys behind you. And then the point man says, okay, well, I'm in the passenger seat, and I'm telling him that I'll take the wheel and that he should focus on firing behind him and fire at the van, not any of the other guys, because none of the other guys matter. Just get the van or whatever. Well, then the difficulty of the pull is reduced by one, but it's a shared responsibility now. So the person doing the pull has to pull one, and the point man has to pull one as well. So it mitigates the risk. I won't go through every single character class, but like the counterfeiter actually has the ability to put stuff back into the Jenga tower.
If you're interested in checking out these rules, trying them yourself or adapting them or whatever you want to do with them, they've been posted on the blog a couple entries back. So I will relink that directly from the show notes. So it's going to be sort of almost a recursive link. Yeah. But nonetheless, it'll get you to the entry you want to see if you want to read these rules and try them out with your own group.
Yeah,
and
I want to welcome Chad to the group of people releasing stuff creative, because you know the first thing that he said the next time I saw him after releasing it? I had made all of these spelling errors, and I have all these new ideas, and I want to release version 2.0. Welcome to releasing creative content.
Well, except, Chad, you have an advantage in that, since it's on the blog,
you can edit it.
Yeah, you can edit it anytime you want. In fact, there's going to be a week before the show drops. You have a week to edit that.
So I printed it out. I ran to Lucid Games at Fear of the Con.
Yeah.
And I printed out copies of the rules for everyone. And it's like, you know, for playing in my game, you get a copy of a free rule system. And I was going through it because I kind of flipped through it to refamiliarize myself with it. And oh, my God, the spelling and grammar. Like, I have questionnaires, right?
Yes. So, which is what we're going to get to. That's the real.
Exactly. We have leading questionnaire, so to speak, that creates the world and creates characters and such. And that's included with the game, or samples of that is included with the game. Well, I had an old version. The point man, who was Leonardo DiCaprio's character, I didn't know what he was called. I didn't know he had a title. So I called him the agent. Well, I changed it to the point man, but on the questionnaire, he's still called the agent. And it's just like, oh, man, I just felt so dumb for missing that stuff.
There was this moment of, it's not exactly pride, because it's like, he's not like my kid or anything. But when he comes to me with all of these things that are just so common of anybody that's releasing anything to the public, that's their own creative endeavor. And it's all of these common things. Oh, the spelling, I wish I'd have done this, I wish I had done that. I smiled.
Version 1 is out there. I want to make a version 1.5 that cleans up version 1. And then I want to make...
Yeah, so version 1.5 on a blog is just called an edit.
Well, yeah. But I want to make a version 2, which is actually a supplement to Inception. It's just talks about running the game. It gives advice. It talks about stuff like doing Penrose stairs that constantly recurse on themselves. Dream logic, basically adding in dream logic to the game.
Right.
Chad, I just want to say kudos to you actually for this because
thanks.
I have yet to hear or see somebody say, wow, that game sucked. I mean, really, from the time you started doing this up until just at Fear the Con, nothing but people really enjoying themselves and really having a good time and a good experience. And that's fantastic. You know, I mean, good for you, man.
Well, thank you.
Yeah,
thank you.
We played it actually as a one-shotter
when Mikey Mason
came down to visit us a couple months ago. And I said, my mm-hmm. run-through, I very much enjoyed it. I think I was playing the point, man. I don't remember for sure.
I think so.
Whenever I play any Jenga tower-based game, I always try to limit my pulls because of the fact that I have mildly shaky hands.
Sure.
I mean, I don't have like Parkinson's disease or anything, but just my hands shake. That's just mm-hmm. how I am. It's the reason I don't paint miniatures. And as a result, it's also the reason that I prefer dice to Jenga towers because dice rolling does not get affected by, you know, the stability of my hands. Jenga towers.
Actually, it's usually helped by shaky hands.
Well, and you know, Chad had some great advice. If either pick a roll that mitigates the amount mm-hmm. of pulls, or look, if the game master's not a dick, then just say, look, my hands shake. Can I have a pinch puller?
Yeah.
Can I just say that somebody else is going to pull on my behalf and we'll just take their results as mine?
Having played in Dread now, I agree with that. The tension comes from somebody doing the pull, so not necessarily that it's you.
So for mm-hmm. the topic we're going to talk about here today, I want to start by giving credit where credit is due. Now, I don't know that this individual invented the idea. Maybe they did, maybe they didn't. I have no idea. But they are certainly the individual that introduced the idea to this circle of people. Which is, Chad, was it Michael that ran Dread the Last Hurrah?
He told us to call him Michael.
Michael, okay. Yeah.
And he said his favorite mispronunciation of his name was Michal.
Yes, which is the actual proper like Polish pronunciation.
Yeah.
But it's not how he pronounces it.
He did not come up with this. He introduced Dread to me, and I just couldn't stop talking about his absolutely amazing Dread the Last Hurrah game. Dread was written by a group called Tilting Windmills. I don't know the names of the authors. And in Dread, the rules, part of the rules is questionnaires.
Okay. So part of the
rules. And I don't know if they came up with it or not.
Which meow.
Meow.
Speaking of meow, Pat's got us up to 6 Care Bears and 1 orgy.
Oh, they're all in there.
There's a story here that I'm sure I can't tell on the mic.
Probably not. I could describe
there
it.
There does appear to be a narrative to this, but
Oh, there's one underneath you can't even see.
He's no, I can see. I see orange coming out the side there.
There you go.
So, all right. But I guess I'm glad to tickle
somebody.
That
sounds really funny out of context.
Well, I drew from one of my favorite movies, Chris. I'm recreating a scene.
Which movie?
Cheerleaders.
Oh, very
Cheerleaders
good.
Yes. 5.
No, just Cheerleaders with Jesse Jane is very good.
Oh, okay.
I recommend it. Those familiar with it will know the scene I'm talking about.
Thank you, Pat. We're going to give you a regular spot on the show where you could recommend a particular porno of the week or something.
Works for me.
Okay. So what specifically he introduced us to, which we latched on to, was this idea of a leading questionnaire. Now, we've talked about on the show before, one of the things that we love is in Shadowrun, there is a section called the 20 questions. And the point of 20 questions is to get you thinking about your character. It asks things like, I don't have it in front of me, but stuff like, what is your character afraid of? Where did your character grow up? Et cetera, et cetera. And it's meant to get you thinking about who your character is. But what Dread does is Dread introduces leading questionnaires. Where Shadowrun might say, what is your character afraid of? Dread instead will say, why are you afraid of the dark?
Right.
So it tells you a truth while asking you a question. So you now know your character is afraid of the dark. What you have to do is explain why. And in doing this, you create a character on the spot through these very leading questions. And the game master has some control even prior to the questions being answered, because the very nature and the content of the questions being asked help create mm-hmm. what's going on in the group. Let me give you an example that was from Fear the Con 4. I was in a Skies of Glass game that Mikey Mason was running, which, by the way, he just absolutely knocked out of the park. And he asked if someone in the group would play the girl. And I said, okay, fine, I'll play the girl. So he hands me a questionnaire for a 17-year-old girl named Christine. And one of the first questions on there is, you and Lyle, who's another character, broke up 2 months ago, but it wasn't about anything he did. Something happened between you and Jed, another character, that changed your outlook on the relationship. What was it? So right there, he just created, long before he even knew who was going to play Christine, he knew that there were two characters who had had a romantic involvement. that romantic involvement had ended, and it had ended as a result of another player character's actions. Though exactly what those are was completely for up to us to define on the spot in the game. And how I chose to answer your question is I said, well, it wasn't a thing about infidelity. The other character simply told me about his brother dying. It spooked me to the point that I figured it'd be easier to be alone and hateful than to love and lose someone you loved. And so I gave him back an answer that he had integrated into the game.
I'm looking at that question. Dan has it on the screen here. And there's a lot of context in the question. There's actually, was that two, three sentences before it actually asked the question?
It actually caught me off guard when he read it, because it's not the kind of leading questions I'm used to seeing.
I'm used to, and not to say that there's anything wrong with
well, and
that,
you need something more,
really
more
cool.
traditional, like you talk about a little bit on further. Like, what did Elder Harmon tell you when you asked him to go hunting with the boys?
Yeah, exactly.
And that's a more of a straight shot question. There's no setup prior to the question.
What strikes me about that questionnaire is how different it is from mine when I write questionnaires. I want stingers. I want a poignant, short question that has just enough information to hit hard and make you think, but requires the player to fill out a lot of the context and a lot of that. Mikey, in his questions, provide not all of them, and it's not like he's providing a book. He's providing a little bit of context that leads into the question.
Right.
Now, really cool.
Yeah,
really cool
idea. Certainly on that first one he did, as you guys noted, there's like, what, three sentences there, two or three sentences before
that,
the question.
That's a total setup.
But right when we get down to like the last question on my sheet, what rumor did you hear about what's happening in the outside world? That's wildly open-ended.
Yeah.
And what's I had fun with was just for S&G, since I know the overarching plot of Size of Glass, I actually gave him a real rumor.
Oh,
like,
really?
A part of the real actual super plot of the setting, because I was curious if he would use it or not. And he didn't. He did use some other stuff I gave
him. Does he know that you did that?
No, I don't.
Because he's digging through it. He's like, oh my God, where is it? What is it?
Desperately scrambling for papers right now.
Why did I save these?
So, but there's some moments like, what did Elder Harmon tell you when you asked him to go hunting with the boys? There's one that kind of cuts the middle.
You have something you want to give Lyle. What is it? To me, that's a stinger question, even though it's too...
Well, because, you could put it in one question. Yeah. What is it you
what
want to
give
Lyle?
Give Lyle? Exactly. Yeah. That's a stinger question to me. I personally really like these poignant, short stinger questions because I want the character to interpret it wildly.
Now, let me ask...
Now, in a setting like Skies of Glass, where there's more, well, setting than, say, Inception, I think Mikey did the right thing because he's providing a little bit of framework for the players to use with their questions, to use with their answers. In something like Inception, the players create the mark. The mark is the guy who they're going to jump in his dream and they're going to do that. And the mark is the setting because you go into the dream. And I personally want them to go wide open. I want them to wildly interpret what they're writing. I don't want to have any control over, or as little control over as possible. I can see doing that, like what Mikey's doing, because he's making a community. He's making a town or a group of people. I didn't play in the game,
well,
but this is what
you're
I'm assuming.
When we sat down, before we were even given those questionnaires, or maybe right after, I don't remember the exact order of events,
right,
but point being, when we sat down, he definitely said to us, here's the town you're living in. Here's a little bit about what's going on. Here's kind of the situation your group is in right now. Then he handed us the questionnaires or at some point, you know, something like that. We knew the setting. What we didn't know was the characters. And that is certainly a difference, Chad, between what you're describing with Lucid, is that in Lucid, you're defining the setting, not just the characters.
Right.
And now, neither's right or wrong.
Right. No, they're
getting,
totally.
Basically, getting to the heart of it is the type of questions you ask and the type of leading questions can be adjusted for the type of game you're running.
Yes.
Yeah. Different types of questions lead better to different kinds of games.
You as a game master only have to surrender as much or as little control as you want to surrender in the creation of the game. I'll tell you, one of the great things about this is if you are trying to run a one-shot game or run a quick game, an improv game, this is wonderful because of the fact that if you have the questions extremely open-ended, the players write the plot for you, whether they realize they're doing so or not.
Tell people about the mark that you're responsible for making in your
Chad,
Inception game.
In my questionnaire, I don't remember all the questions.
Sure.
One of them was something to the effect of, why are you having trouble attacking this mark? Or something to that effect.
Why do you feel guilty about running?
And the response I gave him was, I'm not sure I feel right doing this to children.
Yeah.
And passed it back to him, which was not at all what he was expecting. He was expecting, I used to be drinking buddies with this guy or something.
What I've run the game like 5 times. I've used the same questionnaire each time, gotten totally radically different answers. And when they were filling it out, I was explaining to them, it's like, you guys are technically making the mark. I sit down, I don't have the mark in my mind. Dan wrote that down, and I told them before I even saw Dan's answer, it's like, whatever you guys write for this mark, I'm going to run with. I'm just going to figure it out. And then, Dan, you look at me with this big eating grin, and you're like, I dare ya. I dare ya. And then you wrote that bomb out. Somebody else, I forget who, hands me a questionnaire that says, the mark's married. And so I have this 9-year-old kid who's married, and I'm like, how am I going to do that?
But you did it. You pulled it off. He was a Middle Eastern child.
Yes.
Who came from a very traditional family and was in an arranged marriage with a woman who I believe was in her 20s.
Yeah.
Even though he was too young to really care
and
was too young to be involved in that, he was currently married to or betrothed to or whatever the exactly right terminology is to a woman who is a good deal older than he was.
And I think that's the advantage of having these, like I said, the stinger questions.
Yeah. You know what was fun about that? Hmm. It was the first time I have ever seen Chad actually taken back by something. He has all of these sheets that are in front of him. He's like, okay, everyone run upstairs, grab a drink, get ready. I need about 5 minutes to sort out what I'm going to do here. When he had all of them in front of him, he wouldn't have been so surprised setting up a game without these kind of questions.
And like I was saying, that's what I really love about the short leading questions, because I want my players to write a lot. I leave a pretty good amount of space on there. Again, I think that in Mikey's game, I don't think that stingers would really work, or all stinger questions would work.
There was a setting and a continuum this had to fit into.
And what's really cool,
let's face it, Inception is contextless.
Yes.
I mean, even if you watch the movie, the movie is almost contextless. I mean, yeah, there's some history to one or two of the characters, but for the most part, it just kind of happens and then ends. You don't get the sense that, I don't know, maybe it was just me, but Skies of Glass is not like that. You know,
Skies of Glass is
there's a bigger world out there that this has to fit into. Yeah. And the same would be true if you tried to apply this to D&D.
Yeah.
If you tried to apply this to Battletech, if you tried to apply this to Dresden, if you try to take this in any other game, it could work just as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you as a game master can establish as little or as much as you want and let the players have some kind of a lead freedom, a nose-led freedom, but you'd have the same limitations Mike does. I don't think it's a problem. It's just you can tweak this.
I think tweaking is a better way to limitation.
To fit that, okay, we're going to play a Forgotten Realms game. So you could just put in, okay, here's what Shadowdale is, in case you're not familiar with it. You refuse to go there. What happened in Shadowdale that keeps you from going back?
And I think that's great, especially for a con game. When they're filling the stuff out, if you're playing in any established setting, you do one or two lines per question that provide context related to the question. So that way, you can tell them about their town, about their city, about their country, their religion, their people, their society, without having to sit there and go, okay, guys, we're in a 3-hour game, and I'm going to spend the next half an hour telling you what the story of the game is. And
there's a middle road, too. For Dread the Last Hurrah, he starts off with, here are what all of your characters, here's how they're related to each other. Here's how they're connected. And then you start doing your questionnaire. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of splitting the difference between the way Mikey ran it and the way you ran it.
This is one of the things I want to throw out here along the way. And we've got some questions as well that were specifically posed to me by Sergeant Dan, the other Dan from Fear the Con.
Yes. Only one man made me do 50 push-ups. So.
One of the thoughts that occurred to me while we were prepping this was this is in some ways both working for and against the idea of a group template.
Mm-hmm.
It works with the idea of a group template because the game master, in writing the questions and phrasing the questions, can build relationships.
Yeah.
For example, Mikey set up that two of the characters had been dating. There's already a group template type piece of information right there.
But it's one that the players
but let me pose this as a question. What do you do with as a game master, especially if this is meant to be a longer game, not a one-shotter, if you get back answers that either A, don't form a cogent group, or B, you're struggling to write these questions in the first place because since the players will be answering them without collusion, you're worried about ending up with a completely dysfunctional group. And not dysfunctional, it's cool, but dysfunctional is in this campaign ain't going to last past the first night. We hate each other and kill each other works in a con game. It doesn't work for, you know.
When I make mine, I design it so the group can't work together. I engineer
contradictory goals, yes.
Opposition, tension.
Potential for a traitor.
Potential for traitors, jealousies. I engineer that into the questions. And what's interesting is that depending on the person who gets it, like I said, I've run this game 5 times. I've gotten 5 totally different games.
Yes.
But like the traitor one, if I hand Dan the traitor questionnaire, you as a person, you don't like the whole traitor mechanic. And that's cool. That's totally preferential. You will work the wording of your answer to where it mitigates the level of traitor that your character is. And that's totally cool. That's that as an improv GM, I totally want to roll with that. I totally want to get that. If I hand it to somebody else like Johnny,
John will be the traitor.
John's going to play it up in a way that I didn't even see.
By the end of the game, you will really be sure if you and John are actually friends or not.
Yes.
So Chris, what was it you were about to say?
That was kind of one of the questions I had as you were going on a little bit ago. What do you do if you encounter that where you do get some contradictory information or things that you just can't quite make fit? Now, granted, obviously, in Chad's case for this, you can and certainly can engineer it to make it go a certain way. But when you are dealing with a longer than a one session thing, you could encounter that problem. Do you just toss it? How do you work this stuff out?
Let me respond to half that question, and I'll kick the other half to Chad. That I want to take is, despite the fact that I was the one who posed the question, one of the answers that occurred to me while posing the question in show prep was, okay, what do you do if the group isn't terribly cogent? But one thing Chad pointed out with his traitor thing is that since these questions are leading, you can also build a relationship. Mm-hmm. You can say, look, I want this group to work together. Instead of why will I betray so-and-so, why do I care so deeply about so-and-so? Right. Why are you here? You can start to ask questions that build group. Now, the other sort of aspect of the question you ask is, what do you do with information that is outright problematic? And Chad, this happened to you in one of your run-throughs of Inception recently.
There were.
With the Vietnam answer.
Oh, yeah. So I want to hit on, like, what if there is contradiction?
Okay.
Somebody, they had a question about another character at the table, and basically they said, well, blah, 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 and we dated for a while, and blah, 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 and I'm reading them, and they didn't collude on the answers, because I haven't read them in secret. I look at the other character, and I go, do you want to be female? They're like, well, do you need me to be? And it's like, well, he kind of said this in his response, and it's just like, we can maybe work it another way. He's like, no. I can play a female. That's absolutely no problem. And I'm like, fair enough. In another game I played, actually, this was at Gen Con, one of the players answered something about the mark, and it was another dating question, I think. I wasn't too clear on it because I don't quite remember. But anyway, it was another dating question with the mark, establishing that the mark might have been female. And then somebody else established in their questionnaire that the mark was male. And so I looked at the guy and I'm like, is your character homosexual? And he's like, he can be. I'm like, do you have a problem? Like, I don't have a problem with that. I don't have a problem with that. It doesn't really affect anything in the game, but it's just, there it is. And so you could just ask a couple of questions to kind of clear things up and make sure, is that cool with you? I also tell my players that if you are writing an answer to a question that defines in a very specific way someone else, ask them if it's okay to collude with them on the question.
I guess the other way you could approach it is to simply say, this is perception.
Yeah.
That's what I was going to throw out as well.
If you have two people who write wildly contradictory things, that's because these two people may have seen different sides of the same event, misinterpreted an event, who knows what, but it's very possible that either they are equally true or equally untrue. It's simply how you look at the situation.
Right.
If you ask three witnesses to a robbery what happened, you'll get three different stories that won't be the same.
Exactly. And they don't even have to be inaccurate. They could all be 100% right and yet sound wildly different. A great example we just talked about was, it's a little boy and he's married.
Yeah.
Those sound like contradictory ideas, but there are ways to reconcile them, presuming you're creative enough. Let's say he had not come up with that. Let's say Chad had not thought of the arranged marriage on the fly. He could have just as easily said that this is a kid who has a crush to the point he thinks he's married.
Right.
He's obsessed. He's obsessed. And so there's all kinds of ways you can look at it and take this information and bring it down together. But if you're done with that, I want to get back to the problematic
answers.
Yeah,
you're asking about the Vietnam question.
Yeah, so let's go with the Vietnam example, because this one came up for you. If you're using this concept in any game on the face of the earth, D&D, Star Trek, Star Wars, let's say you get an answer back that really kicks you in the nuts.
Well,
how do you roll with that?
Well, one of the things in the very last game I ran at Fear the Con, I had a problem because I was running it in the last slot. My brain was turning to jello, and I learned something that year. never run a deep, immersive, serious game in the last slot because I could not keep up with my players. They were
except
doing
for all you other GMs that do it. We thank you for doing it.
Well, run a comedy game or something light, I guess. Or at least that's what I
think it comes down to a simpler thing of whatever the exact what Latin is for know thyself.
Yeah. I did not know myself. And this was my first con running games, too. Official games that people signed up for, and there was like an expectation there.
Right.
I had a great time. My silent memory crew, they saved the world, but they sacrificed themselves to do it. The Vietnam thing, because my questions are about the mark. It's about their target. And so I take their answers that are about the mark, and I create this person, and then that person is the character, and that person is also becomes the setting, and it also becomes the whole plot of the game. And I just reflect back whatever they do. They can do whatever they want. And I'm just kind of there arbitrating and reflecting back on them. And I set a goal and then they run through that. So this guy was a soldier and he was an old man. So that means at the time that they were playing Vietnam vet and he was this and that. And so his special forces. Well, because they latched on to the special forces and the Vietnam or the soldier aspect, the Vietnam aspect of it, the dream that they chose to create, because the players choose the dream. They tell me what the dream they're making.
If you've not seen Inception, the architect designs the dreamscape.
Right.
Spoiler free explanation.
Yeah. So what they decide to do is they decide to make Vietnam because the idea is that you earn their trust. And then you go into the second layer of the dream and then you use that trust basis. It kind of bleeds through.
That makes a lot of sense with what you've set up.
Yeah. It bleeds through. The trust bleeds through. And then you use that bleed through trust to solve this guy's problems or exasperate his problems, but basically use his problems against him to achieve your goal within his own dreams. Well, and I described this to the guys at the end of the thing. They completely threw me for a loop because what most people do is they create expensive hotels and dinner parties. They go through and it's this sort of James Bondy type thing that they set up or diners in Times Square. It's what you guys did or a high school prom. It's basically expensive hotels and dinner parties. Well, these guys create Vietnam in the jungle at a POW camp. And it was just really difficult to wrap my head around. I was tired to begin with. And it's just like, these guys are taking this in a totally new concept that I wasn't used to.
Why that was so problematic is because at a dinner party, you have the dreamer, you have the invaders into the dream, which is
the players,
and then you have the other populace.
The subconscious projections.
Yes, exactly. That every other
of the mark.
Correct. That every other person in that dream is a subconscious outcropping of the dreamer. It's, you know, look, when you go to bed at night and dream, there's more than you in your dreams. But in truth, you are every person but you in that dream. Right. Well, here's the problem. Most of what you're trying to do in that game is social manipulation.
Right.
You're trying to avoid conflict because conflict's problematic and instead interact with and kind of dance around all these other subconscious impersonations created by the dreamer.
And you can also learn information from the subconscious projections.
Well, all you have is
people trying to hurt you.
Yeah, you have an army.
Yeah.
That's already not what this is supposed to be. You can't interact with a bunch of guys who don't even speak your language and are all trying to kill you.
And it was interesting, too, because they were in Cambodia, actually. All the Cambodians spoke Cambodian because the special forces guy spoke Cambodian. So they couldn't really talk to them. And the Cambodians, the Khmer Rouge, were enemies. They were combatants. They were trying to kill him. So, of course, they were all hostile.
You
can't talk to
them. Buy them a drink and try and manipulate them.
So what I had to do, not to get in too much of a game of story, but what I had to do is that when they got to this POW camp to rescue hostages, because they're trying to build trust by working together in an environment familiar to the mark that puts stress on them that they can work with, is they get to the POW camps. They have like the tiger cages where they have the bamboo cages that people are tied up in. Well, instead of soldiers, they're civilians. Well, instead of civilians, there are 5-year-old girls who are all identical. I had to start twisting dream logic around in there and make a freaky sort of setting to where they can look at that. And the girls they all had stuff that they all represented about the mark and that the guys could work with.
Let's take this out of Inception, though, for a minute. Let's say this is D&D. You're playing a D&D game, and the plot the game master has in mind is that this is a group of people who are meant to be emissaries from the humans to the Elven nation. And the campaign is supposed to be about your desire to bring some kind of peace between the humans and elves. Okay, I'm just making crap up on the fly. And somebody writes in their background, not realizing what you had in mind for the campaign, that they hate elves in a murderous way to the point they will kill on sight.
Sounds like a party.
I know. I realize some game masters would be like, sounds like a great game to me, but just play along.
Yeah.
Pretend that's problematic. For a moment, let's just pretend this breaks what you had in mind for this campaign. What do you do with an answer like that?
I would say he does the same thing he did the first time he ran Silent Memories. He sets us aside and says, okay, I can't give you the whole plot here, but what you've written here will make it more difficult for you. In our case, we didn't have the full questionnaire. We just had, here are our advantages and disadvantages. Yeah. And based on what he knew about the plot of that game, certain things just were never going to come up. So he set us aside without giving away the plot, just said, you might want to rethink that answer. If you want to stick with it, I'll find a way to make it work.
Right.
But it's going to be more complicated on you.
I think the Game Master also has an opportunity prior to handing out the questionnaire to say, look, I want you guys to understand some things about this game. And this is where I don't think these leading questionnaires in any way exclude a group template. Right. You could still sit down and say, look, as
it's
a group.
It's actually more of a modified group template or maybe a alternate group template.
And I don't think they're exclusive to indie gaming or narrative style gaming.
That's why I'm trying to
totally complementary to traditional gaming.
Oh, absolutely.
And that's why for this example, I wanted to grab D&D is I want to get this out of the indie thought and into the mainstream sort of stuff of saying, look, you could sit down with this D&D game and say, okay, group template. You guys are a group sent by the court of this king to make peace with the elves. With that in mind, here's a quick rundown of the setting of Forgotten Realms, if you're not familiar with it. With all that in mind, now here's your questionnaires.
Yeah, that's exactly what happens in Dread the Last Hurrah. Mm-hmm. He sits you down before he gives you the questionnaires. Okay, these are your characters. This is how you know each other. You're getting ready to do this. It's not the plot of the whole game. It's just what you're starting off doing. And you go into the questionnaires with that in mind, knowing what he's basically set out, what would in a campaign be the first session.
Yeah.
And then that kind of frames it.
There's really nothing wrong with doing that either because, you know, you're still providing a framework of sorts, as loose as it may be, but it's still a framework and it still gives them plenty of latitude to go and add to it and enhance it and as a group point of direction that they want to travel and how they want to undertake this. And there's, you know, more than enough for you as a GM to have stuff to work with there where you're not feel like you're railroading them.
Yeah, and I'm still a big fan of before the campaign, when you're creating your characters, everyone having that conversation. What would I like to get out of this campaign? That includes the GM. For the GM, here's what I would like to get out of this campaign. And if everyone knows that going in, I don't think you're going to run into these issues.
I'm going to come from a purely player's aspect on this one because we've danced around this a couple times and we've never really landed on until maybe now. You talked about doing this in a more long-standing campaign. I think these questionnaires are great for a con game or, in other words, a one-shot game. Mm-hmm. I personally would not want to do this in a long-standing campaign, really anything that lasts beyond like a night's play. I wouldn't even want to do this if it's going to be like 3 or 4 weeks, maybe. Maybe I would, but okay. And what I mean by that is this. No, shut up, Chris. I'm talking,
you
know, God
you
damn
shut
it.
Up. I got a damn question for you. What is the difference?
Well, hold on. Chris, hold on.
I haven't even made my point and you're already asking me the difference?
Can you just make your damn point?
That's my question for you is, why not?
I'm actually cutting Dan off, not cutting you off, Pat.
This is why I have to talk so fast on this thing, because everybody cuts me off. Chad's being very... thank you, Chad. You're respecting my talking. I can't talk in a nice, normal tone in a, you know, a slow pace like Chad does. I've got to race like a goddamn horse to get my point out.
All right, okay. So why not?
I'm not cutting you off. I'm cutting Dan off.
Mother f***, you're doing it again.
All right.
Pat, so
pull your
panties
out of your ass.
What I'm getting at is, in a one-shot game, in a short game, I think this is great because, for the reason you're saying, we've got a limited amount of time. What you can do with this is you can combine a whole lot of things in there. You can combine the world setting, the interrelationships between the characters in there. And I think that's great because when you're talking about, we're going to do this in 4 hours, like in a con or even in a one night setting, time is the enemy. But on the flip side of that, when I play a campaign, when I sit down to make a brand new character, and I actually grade up against the group template for the same reason, when I'm making a new character for a campaign, I don't want my relationships with the other characters to be dictated by a questionnaire that has leading questions on it from the GM or from anybody else. I want my relationships to develop through gameplay and through RP at the table from here on. I don't necessarily need to know why Wayne and I dated in the past, you know, and we're broken up now. What happened because of Dan's character? That's something that I want to develop as we go along.
Well, you know,
that's my opinion. I know I'm sure there's a lot of players that don't care about that, but I personally
agree with you.
I want to go forward. Well, so
I actually agree.
And that's
with
why
you,
I say for longstanding campaigns,
we did it because I'm a sexy ginger.
You know the answer.
Yeah. All right, well, Pat, let me respond in a couple ways. First off, that's not at all how a group template works. So I don't think that's really going to be an issue with a group of templates.
I know. Generally speaking,
group templates are not leading.
It's not like that, no.
But I do see what you're saying, that with a questionnaire, what it does take away from you is the ability to decide. If it says, why were you two dating? The answer of we were never dating has been, by implication, taken off the table.
Or even, why do you hate the elves?
Yeah.
I don't want to play a character that hates the elves.
Yeah. Well, to me, there's a definite difference between a leading questionnaire and a questionnaire. A questionnaire says, what is your job? A leading questionnaire says, why do you hate your job?
Right.
And I get what you're saying with that. I totally get what you're saying with that. To me, I think that there are pitfalls with using a leading questionnaire for a long-standing campaign. The GM railroads the characters. It defines that you have a job and you hate the job. It defines that you're dating Wayne and because you love gingers.
Even saying that, I think there is a difference between, why do you hate your job and why do you hate being a garbage man?
Right.
Why do you hate your job?
Well,
if you want to be a wizard, you could say, I hate my job because I'm a knight and I want to be a wizard.
I even think that saying, why do you hate your job, can be too leading for a lot of people.
What's the thing? I didn't create a 2-page backstory, and in that, I talk about how much I love my job.
Well, right.
And
you're already pigeonholing them into acting a certain way.
I think that questionnaires for a long-standing campaign are great because, to me, because I'm a hippie GM, I think the character sheet is the enemy because people get too focused on it. There's nothing inherently wrong with a character sheet or attributes or rules or anything like that. But to me, people get way too laser focused on it. And the thing that I hate is the guard comes up to you and says, oh, what are you doing here? Pick up the character sheet, pick up dice. And you're like, do I have a skill to this? No, have a conversation. Sorry, mini rant. I think that a questionnaire gets the focus off the character sheet, gets the focus off the stats and the numbers, which are fine. But it starts asking you things like, you know, what is your favorite color? What is your job? Where do you come from? Dan has some very pertinent ones on his questionnaire that he gives out, like, how do you feel about killing? Does killing bother you?
Yeah, and it's the questionnaire Chad's talking about is not a leading one.
Yeah.
It's an open-ended questionnaire.
Yeah, it doesn't say, why do you feel bad about killing someone? It says, does killing bother you? And I absolutely agree. I think as hippie and crazy as I am in GMing, or at least people tell me I'm crazy in GMing, I think that a leading questionnaire for something that I'm really trying to flesh out and develop is not what I want, because I don't want the game master defining my character for me. I want to work with the game master, and I want to work with the other players, and I want to say, hey, is it all right if I do this? Or the game master makes offers and says, well, hey, how about this? Or how about that? Why don't, you know, there's this great wizard that I'm going to have in the plot, and you're a wizard. You want to be his apprentice? No, not really. No, thanks. No problem. Leading questionnaire says, how do you feel about being sold to the wizard as an apprentice?
Personally, I like splitting the difference. Let's say you have 10 questions. They're not all going to be leading. Give the person the option to just throw 2 questions out. That way you're mix and matching. You're getting people
to
think.
Some veto questions.
Exactly.
Well, I think that this is definitely something where the game master, if they really want to do this, they can say, okay, everybody's getting a questionnaire. Because I think there's absolutely nothing wrong with asking a player what their character's favorite color is. It gets them thinking beyond the character sheet and how big their sword is.
I couldn't even answer what my favorite color is, let alone a character.
Green is my favorite color. And if noted by everything to do with Fear the Boot, there's all this green all over the blog and the forums and everything.
Chaz designed none of it.
I've designed none of it, yeah. But I've pushed the color choice whenever there is a, should we go this color or this color? Green. And yeah.
But I see, though, what you guys are saying. There's a variety of ways here to mitigate Pat's concern. I don't think there's any way to eliminate it.
No.
I got
a follow-up question, though, to Pat's to what he was saying. Well, I certainly can understand where you're coming from. I mean, I get it. But if the questions asked are, on the whole, not necessarily damaging. I mean, you know, for example, like the whole dating question. That certainly establishes something in a character relationship, but it doesn't establish anything beyond the fact that you may have dated. If that's left essentially open-ended, isn't the relationship or the character development that could come from that question, isn't that enriching enough for you down the road that makes it not so bad to have questions like that?
I don't want a game master defining that for
me. No, I don't want that either, because that's like, okay, if I'm role-playing, if I'm starting a new campaign, I'm meeting these characters essentially for the first time. That, to me, feels like is the same as if you would say to me in real life, mm-hmm. I just met this one girl. I've never met her before, but oh yeah, by the way, you dated in the past, but you just don't, you know, it's like you don't know it or whatever. That's awkward. That was an awkward example.
But that's why I think
I like to develop these things as they go, because I don't know these people. I don't know these characters at all. So for you to tell me on a questionnaire leadingly like that, well, oh yes, you already have a relationship with this person. I don't know anything about that person. Well, you know that person's personality.
You know what the scheme that I really like, though? It's kind of splitting the difference. Is I'm running a game. You guys are all players in my game. And I have some, what I think are really good plot hook ideas, right? And I'm not really sure how to get you guys hooked into it. Well, I have two questionnaires. And I say, one questionnaire is just, what's your favorite color? Do you have a problem with killing? Tell me about your parents. That sort of stuff. If anybody who wants it can have this and they fill it out, and I'll try and draw information from it for plot hooks and whatnot. I have a leading questionnaire. The leading questionnaire ties directly into the plot. There are names dropped in here. There are plot bombs dropped in here. You must keep it secret. If you take this and fill it out, you get two things. One, you are directly tied to the plot in a very heavy way, because it's this heavy collusion. Two, I'll give you some bonus. D&D, I'll give you, you know, a magic sword, or I'll give you an extra spell, or I'll give you in some system with binnies, I'll give you an extra binny, an extra perk, a little extra something for adding to the plot. But it's optional. You don't have to take the leading one. And if no one takes the leading one, that's no skin off my back. Nobody wanted to roll those dice.
And Pat, one comment I would make is, and I completely get where you're coming from, because I have played in games with people who felt the same way, where they really did not want the GM dictating what their characters like to them. Depending on the campaign, sometimes I feel very strongly about that myself. There are some games where I really know I want to play this dude and I don't want the GM tampering with that. There are other games where I don't feel strongly, so if the GM gave me something, I'd happily roll with it.
And I've said I'm perfectly for this in a one-shot game. I've done it. I think it's great.
I think the only part of that that I think I would just absolutely disagree with is the part about the first game must be the first time I've met the rest of these characters.
That was an extreme. I made a bad example. Okay. Like I said, it was very awkward.
Sorry.
My point was, is that I'm sitting down with these characters. I have not role played at the table with you guys playing these new characters.
You as the player don't know those characters.
I don't know how Wayne is going to play his character. I don't know how Dan, I don't know how you're going to play your new character. So for me to answer a question where we have whatever relationship it is with your character, before we even play it and establish our personalities, it flies in my face.
So the issue here is not that you've defined an in-character truth, it's that there is an out-of-character metagame truth, which is that even if these characters have known each other for 20 years, this is the first time the players as these characters have ever interacted.
And I really feel for where Pat's coming from, because when I make a character that I'm going to play, it takes me at least two or three gaming sessions to really get into it. The Skies of Glass campaign that we played, where we played the mercenary, my character was not a nice person. And this dark side and making the right call. And a lot of times he didn't make the right call. I didn't know that when I made the character. That was not written into the character. And that was something that I just kind of developed and wanted to play with. And it was situations were presented to him and he kind of went left when he should have went right. And left was kind of a dark path. And then he went a little bit more left and then went a little bit. It's like, you know what? This character is kind of a dark guy. And then so I started playing him like that. I started making, much to the chagrin of my very good and well-meaning valorous companions, I started playing him darker.
And this ties right into the exact question that I was asked by Sergeant Dan, which I think I mentioned earlier, which is what he noted during our Skies of Glass game that we were playing with Mikey, that in my answers, I gave quite a bit of information. Mm-hmm. I gave several sentences, I mean, sometimes close to a paragraph of information. He said that his answers were much shorter. Mm-hmm. Now, some of that you could chalk up to the fact that I just knew more about the setting than he did, for obvious reasons. And so I was able to just say things like, oh, well, I did this and it ties into that and whatever. But some of that really did come down to the fact that I was more comfortable just saying, this is who my character was. He said that, you know, in his case, look, there's a lot of things that he's not going to figure out until he's tried playing the character. And I don't know, he didn't go into detail. It could be, depending on the person, maybe it's a creative issue where you just struggle coming up with things that fast. Maybe it's not a creative issue. Maybe you could, but until you try the character out, you don't get a feel for how you want to play them, how they're going to fit into the world. I mean, I've done things before in roleplay where I surprised myself with something my character did. My character just on the spot busts out an answer or a comment. It's like, wow, that totally changes their background in a way that I didn't have in mind prior to this moment that lightning struck. So I get that. I totally get why some people either would not like these questionnaires or would feel the need to give much more short, vague answers than like what I gave Mikey. Mm-hmm.
There's nothing wrong with that.
No, there's not. There's absolutely not.
Actually, that's something that actually kind of came up in the Dread game. A lot of us did do some very short answers. And after it was over, we all read our answers back to each other. And some of them were things that were very open for interpretation. Some of them were just things that it was left open-ended. The question may be very pointed, but your answer can be fairly open-ended.
This is why I think, like so many other things we've talked about, this is not the way to game.
No, it's another tool
in the toolbox. Let's keep, you know, beating on that old chestnut. It's another tool in the toolbox, because that's exactly what it is. This is something that is going to work well for the right game with the right group of people in the right situation. It should be an option you guys consider. But certainly, as the game master, you need to say, okay, how much control do I need to have over the plot or over the group template to make my game work? The players have to be asked, how much are you willing to give up in character creation? Because leading questions do take, no matter how much you mitigate it, they do take something. There is some kernel of truth that is predefined. And are you okay with that? As a game master, other advice I would give is when you're writing these questions, is there something you need to be true of the party? Is there something you need to be true of the world? If so, you better be careful to either build that in as a presumption in one of the leading questions, or don't ask about it, because you may not like the answer you get back. But I think this is a great option that I don't see get used very often. And I'm not saying I think this should be the new fad in gaming, but I think but I think it would be used more often if more people had seen it in action, had been exposed to the idea.
Would any of you consider doing this not at the beginning of the campaign, but after the campaign's been going?
Oh, you stole my question.
When you have a season break, when you... Any of these times where instead of right before you start.
Let me answer that with how I was going to ask that exact same question. So we're running a fantasy campaign, the one with Gnarl and Saren and Sir William and Bernaldo. And that was for you, Jeff. The campaign took a break. It took like they did all this stuff and they achieved the sort of goal of the plot. They achieved the plot. And then we took a year break. The characters took a year break, not the players, where they could do anything they wanted. And they kind of told me what they did, and I reinterpreted back what happened. And we're in the second chapter of this game. And then they're going to achieve the plot eventually, maybe, hopefully. And I want to do another break. And when we do that break, I haven't decided yet, but I'm thinking either doing anywhere from a year to 5 years of time passing. What I was thinking of while we were doing the show is, wow, wouldn't it be cool if I did leading questions? Like, they tell me, what are you doing in the next 5 years? And they each go around, they say, I'm doing this, I'm doing this, I'm doing this, I'm doing this. And I'm like, okay, you're going to get an email. And I want you to fill out the questions of the email. And they're going to be a series of questions based on what they did. They're going to be leading questions based on what they told me that they're doing. So it's a direct tie-in both to the plot, to what they're doing.
So it might be something like you say, Dan, what are you doing during this year? And I say, well, I really want to work on strengthening the numbers of my clan. And so you send me an email that says, what did you do the day that so-and-so showed up and tried to take over authority?
Right.
And you know what's great about that is the fact that at this point, you're now, number one, really not defining anything about my character. Mm-hmm. You're only defining things about the plot. And two, you're not defining things about anyone else's character.
Right.
Now, I guess you could.
I wouldn't do... So what did you do in this 5 years? You're strengthening your thing. Okay, that's cool. What did you do when Pat's character walked into your village and betrayed you?
Yeah.
No, that's right out.
I also wonder
I'll let him betray you himself.
I also wonder if it could be a tool to save campaigns. If you've had these long breaks, could this revitalize
you just need a bigger hard
drives? Nice.
Yeah, like that.
So many horrible jokes there. Could this be something that would revitalize a campaign, though? If you've, let's say you've missed 4 weeks in a row and you want to get back into it, shoot this questionnaire out before the game starts.
Especially if the game master remembers more than the players do.
Yeah.
Where the players have forgotten a lot of the plot, the
Are
game
you trying
master,
to imply something about me?
No, I really wasn't, though. I would say what Wayne's describing, I think, would actually work better with a notes heavy GM, so because they'd be able to look back and be like, okay, this is where we were. And then, let's now re-ask some entry questions to get you guys back into the groove of things. Chris, you got any thoughts on this?
No, you know, actually, what you said right there, I think, would have been my thoughts on that. That's a good way to go. And you can re-energize people by, you can, you know, lay out some plot seeds to get that interest back up and going again. Absolutely.
I think it's all about all I got on this one. Once again, be sure to check the show notes for the links to the coverage of Fear the Con 4. Also put out a link to Chad's Lucid role-playing game. Maybe eventually follow us up with a Silent Memories one. But for now, we'll at least get Lucid up there. And I hope this is something that you guys will could just consider as another option in your game mastering and playing techniques. I know some community issues we need to re-pick up that kind of got lost in the con shuffle, like the charity auction. We will come back around to that stuff probably starting next episode. So thank you guys all for tuning in. Have wonderful games and a wonderful week, and we will all catch you in the same spot and time next week.
See ya.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2011. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.